This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hello, and welcome back to another live show on The People Speak. I am Sophia Ray, your host for the week. Today is Tuesday, October 31st. Tune in every Tuesday, 8 p.m. Central Time, for live interview-style talk radio with various hosts and guests. Here on The People Speak, we encourage audience participation by phoning in questions or comments toll-free from Canada and the USA at 1-888-429-5471. For more information on upcoming shows, log on to bbsradio.com/thepeoplespeak. Tonight's guest is a reoccurring guest from a couple of years ago who did a review on his book, A Cosmic War. Now he is here to discuss a review of his most recent book, Hess and the Penguins, The Holocaust, Antarctica, and the Strange Case of Rudolf Hess. Happy Halloween, and welcome back once again on The People Speak, Dr. Joseph Farrell.
Thank you, Sophia.
You're very welcome. You've been pretty busy since our last interview, I take it.
Yeah, I'm still writing my books and doing my website and blogging and so on.
Great. So let's talk about this book here. Who is Rudolf Hess, and how did you start your research into this Hess myth?
Well, Rudolf Hess was the so-called deputy Führer of Nazi Germany. He was Hitler's personal representative in the Nazi Party. He was also a Reich minister and an SS general. In other words, he was a very, very powerful man. And as head of the Nazi Party, as Hitler's personal deputy, he actually had control of a number of party bureaucracies in addition to a number of elements within the Nazi government itself. So he was extremely powerful. There was virtually nothing that occurred in the Third Reich without him knowing about it. I became aware of Hess, like most people, just are familiar with World War II history. I started researching him several years ago, but I had to do some other books prior to this one, you know, to kind of set the groundwork for it. But basically, he flew to Great Britain, to Scotland, on May 10th, 1941. And it took several decades, really, for the reason for his flight to come out. Initially, during the war, the German propaganda put out the idea that he was insane, which, of course, was really a propaganda goof of the highest order, because that's basically admitting that one of your major leaders is nuts. The British did not reply, really, to any of the German propaganda. They simply acknowledged that they had captured him. And basically, that's the way the story sat until the end of the war. And then, of course, he was sentenced to life in prison and spent the rest of his years from 1946 to August of 1987, when he finally died in Spandau prison.
Okay. Was that prison specifically built for him?
No. Spandau was built prior to World War I. It was actually a prison that was built under the Kaiser, under the German Empire. So it was both a civic and military prison for the German Empire. After the war, the Allies seized it and used it to house seven inmates that had been sentenced by the Nuremberg war crimes tribunals. So after the war, it held only seven people up to the point that Albert Speer and Balder von Schirach, who was the Hitler leader, Hitler youth leader, and then, of course, Speer was the Reich armaments minister. They were released in 1966. So from that point on, the others that had been sentenced had been released prior to that. So from the release of Speer and Balder von Schirach in 1966, I think it was, Rudolf Hess, or whomever, was the only one that was left in that prison. And the four Allied powers maintained their full military guard complement just to guard that one man for the next 21 years.
You say whoever that was. I'm just going to let you take some water here for a moment. You say whoever that was. Now, that might be, the readers might be, or the listeners might be saying, what does he mean? So let's get a little bit into that. He was the last inmate of the seven who supposedly was there. But in your book, you mentioned cloning. And was he a clone? The doppelganger, let's talk about that a little bit.
Well, let's be clear. I did not mention cloning in the book. A double is a different thing than a clone. It is clear to me that there's some evidence that the individual that was imprisoned in Spandau may not have been Rudolf Hess, that the British substituted a double for him at some point during their period when they held him captive from 1941 up until 1946, when they brought him back to Nuremberg to stand trial. The reason that people suspect that he was a double is actually twofold. Back in 1978, a British physician by the name of Hugh Thomas was appointed to the medical staff at the British Military Hospital in Berlin. And as Hess was actually the prisoner of the British up until his sentencing, they were responsible for his medicine and his health. So Dr. Thomas, as a result of his posting to the British Military Hospital there, realized that he might have an opportunity to treat or at least to see Hess. So he familiarized himself with Hess's medical files. And, of course, in the medical files, there were details about Hess's World War I wounds. He was a soldier during World War I for the Imperial German Army and had been wounded both at the Battle of... hello?
I'm sorry. Sorry about that.
He had been wounded at Verdun during the Battle of Verdun and then sustained a major wound on the Eastern Front in Romania in 1917. So Dr. Thomas familiarized himself with Hess's medical file. And then he did have an opportunity to see Hess when he was disrobed for, a routine medical examination. And he noted that this individual did not have any scars of wounds where his medical file indicated that he should have been wounded. And he confirmed this during another examination and began to suspect that Hess was indeed a double. And in fact, he wrote a book called Who Murdered Rudolf Hess, in which he propounds his double theory. Now, it's due to Thomas's book that many people suspect that Hess was indeed a double. And interestingly enough, when Hess was brought to Nuremberg by the British to stand trial, the American OSS station chief in Switzerland during the war, one Alan Dulles, there's a name that'll be familiar to a lot of people. Alan Dulles suspected, for reasons that were never made very clear, but he did suspect that the Hess that everybody was looking at in Nuremberg was not the real Hess. He suspected he was a double. So he brought in a friend of his to examine Hess, who turned out to be none other than Dr. Ewan Cameron, who, of course, is infamous and notorious for involvement in the post-war CIA mind control project called MKUltra. He wanted Dr. Cameron to examine Hess and make a determination if indeed this individual was the real Hess. Well, the British never let Dr. Cameron examine Hess closely, nor would they permit him to examine Hess without his clothes. So, in other words, the suspicion was ratcheted up to a considerable degree that the Hess they were looking at in Nuremberg was not Hess. And then there's a final bit of interesting information with respect to that, and that is that during the Nuremberg trials, Hermann Göring, of course, sat right next to Hess in the dock. And on the other side of Hess, you had the former foreign minister of Nazi Germany, Joachim von Ribbentrop. And when Hess was brought to Nuremberg, he was asked to identify or if he could recognize people that were brought in for him to look at. And they brought in Hermann Göring, and they brought in Hess's old secretary, and Hess, or whomever, was not able to remember who they were. And at one point in the trial, Hermann Göring said very loudly during a recess so that everybody could hear him, he said very loudly, "Come on, Hess, why don't you tell us your big secret, you know?" So there's a little indicator that even Hermann Göring suspected that you know, the individual that was sitting next to him may not have been the real Hess.
And there was a photo in your book that kind of he's looking at that has kind of almost like perplexed, like, who are you?
Yeah.
Like, do you, where, so if this is possibility that's not the true Hess, then what happened with the real Hess?
Well, there are some British researchers by the name of Picknett, Prince, and Pryor that wrote a wonderful book called Double Agenda, I think was the title. And their thesis, which I think is a thesis that's well worth considering, their thesis is that the real Hess at some point was taken secretly to Scotland while a double was planted in other places in Great Britain. And there were two reasons for this. Number one, the British suspected that the Germans or somebody else might attempt to assassinate him. So they created a double to kind of deflect assassination attempts. But the other reason was that Hess himself, when he arrived in Great Britain, made it very clear that he had come there under a flag of truce that had been extended to him by representatives of the royal family. So in other words, he had a kind of diplomatic immunity. And in their research, they cite a number of witnesses that place the real Hess in Scotland rather than in England itself. So in other words, the real Hess was far away from the fake Hess. And in their scenario, they connect Hess, the real Hess, to the aircraft crash, a relatively famous wartime incident where the Duke of Kent, King George VI, the younger brother, perished in an aircraft crash, ostensibly on a mission to go, you know, buck up British morale for British troops that were stationed in Iceland. They theorize, and they present a fairly good case, that the real Hess was on that aircraft and that the real purpose of the flight was to fly him to Sweden, where he would then be returned from Sweden to Nazi Germany, since he had come under a flag of truce. And that with his perishing, they decided to go ahead and substitute the double for the real Hess and play out a kind of charade. So that's their scenario. I tend to agree with it, although in my book I leave the whole question of a double rather open for readers to make up their own mind.
So in the book, you kind of go back between the real Hess and the possible fake Hess. Now, there was, however, in the hospital, a whole ward dedicated to this Hess. And is that possible because it was not the real Hess?
Yeah, in my view, I think it is possible. I cited a couple of books by Hess's son, Wolf Rüdiger Hess, pardon me, who wrote a couple books after the war and after his father had died or whoever had died. And he recounts a couple of very strange incidents where his father or whomever had been taken for some medical examinations. And in one case, he appeared to be very, very drugged and out of sorts, not himself, and not even really able to interact with his son in any intelligent or, you know, intimate family way. And the circumstances are so peculiar that I suggested in the book that perhaps this whole ward in the British military hospital just for Hess was so that they could do mind manipulation, mind control techniques on him. And if he was a double, you know, the purpose of that would be rather obvious, to keep the Hess personality, so to speak, imprinted on the double. So there are a number of very strange things. And you really get an idea that there was a double, because the fellow in Spandau at one point wrote to his nurse. He had an Arab Tunisian nurse. He wrote to his nurse and complained that at a certain juncture when he was captive in Great Britain, that he was not allowed to smoke. And, you know, that's a real tip-off there, because the real Rudolf Hess, like Adolf Hitler, was not only a non-smoker, he was just adamantly opposed to the whole idea. So, you know, that's a little indicator that we may not be dealing with the genuine article after the war is over.
Let's talk a little bit more about the mind control. Now, it wasn't just possibly that this double Hess was under mind control, but the guards as well. And you also mentioned something being put in his food that possibly was LSD.
Right. This is where it gets interesting. As I indicated, Alan Dulles brought in Dr. Ewan Cameron to examine Hess because he suspected that they were dealing with a double. And, of course, Ewan Cameron went on to become a major figure in the post-war CIA MK-Ultra mind control project in the 1950s. And it's interesting because at Nuremberg, Hess, or his double, maintained that he had been mind-controlled, that the British were drugging him. He even went so far as to maintain that many of the Nazi leaders were mind-controlled, you know, in an attempt to rationalize and excuse their murder, you know, during the war. But interestingly enough, when you read what this character at Nuremberg actually says, it does become clear that something was going on in Great Britain, because he talks at one point about saving samples of his silverware from the food that he ate with his British guards. He took his meals with his British guards and with the medical staff in Great Britain. And he said that he was being drugged, and he said that it was some sort of brain poison, and at one point he even called it an acid. And the reason he called it an acid was that he had smuggled food out back to his quarters and kept his fork and spoon in the food, which rapidly ate away the silverware. And so he decided that, yeah, he was being poisoned in some fashion. And interestingly enough, he also complains of constipation when he's under British captivity. And I thought, gee, that's interesting, because, of course, constipation is a symptom of regular LSD use. So, you know, there are lots of little indicators to point not only to the existence of a double, but to some sort of mind manipulation that was going on. And that stands to reason. If you're going to create a double and substitute him for, you know, the number three man in Nazi Germany, you want to make sure that the double has, you know, the proper life memories and so on and so forth. So there's a lot of little indicators that whoever was in Spandau after the war may not have been the real Rudolf Hess.
So basically what I'm picking up here is what you're saying, that this whole thing here might possibly be the first publicly mind control experiment without, you know, only with certain few knowing and the whole world unknowing.
Right, that's exactly what we have. the presence of Alan Dulles and you and Cameron in Nuremberg, particularly with Hess and Dulles suspecting that they're dealing with a double. Yeah, that's exactly what's going on. And whoever it is in Nuremberg, you know, states publicly during his infamous statement to the tribunal, he mentions this himself, that, you know, there was a lot of mind manipulation, mind control going on. So the Hess case is interesting from the standpoint, if you're into the subject of mind control and mind control techniques and technologies, it's really the Hess case that's the first major public example of that, which is intriguing in and of itself.
It is very intriguing. So this is like has like blown up from, you know, the 40s until now. Let me ask you this question here, because originally I started the show to have Tim Boyd on. He's the president of the Theosophical Society, and I noticed in The Grid of the Gods, and when you're talking about the Nazi transmitters, you mentioned the Theosophical Society in a section of your book. And you kind of related the Theosophical Society connected with the Nazi Party. Are you aware of the Theosophical teachings of Agartha, which holds the capital, its capital is Shambhala, and it's called the Middle Earth. And it's said that there's an entrance that the Theosophical Society teaches that's in Antarctica. Do you think that this is connected with the Nazis' expedition there?
That's a much more complex question. Let me put it this way. Rudolf Hess was a member of the interwar Thule Gesellschaft, the Thule Society, which was this kind of proto-fascist, occult-based secret society with you know, its own private armies and everything else that you would figure in Germany at that time. Rudolf Hess was a member of this society. And this society did have as one of its teachings, and it probably does come ultimately from some sort of theosophical influence, it did have as one of its teachings that the Aryan race, the white Caucasian race, came to this planet from off world, and that it landed at the poles. And usually, in their understanding, that meant the North Pole. But Rudolf Hess, as the deputy Führer of the Nazi Party and a member of that society, and himself an individual with an interest in the occult, would certainly have known of that teaching. The real question is, did he have a hand or knowledge of the Nazi Antarctic expedition, and did he have knowledge of whatever it was that they may have found down there? And to that, my answer has always been an unequivocal yes, because, again, he simply was too powerful in terms of the positions that he held prior to his flight not to have known not only of the expedition, but whatever it may have found down there. Now, the actual sponsor of the expedition was Reichsmarshal Hermann Göring, you know, the head of the Luftwaffe. And Hermann Göring was the man that picked the people that went on that expedition. And, you know, he's a nuts and bolts military guy. He's not interested in occult lore or anything like that. He's interested in pure military economic things. And, of course, Antarctica is very resource mineral rich. So he sponsors this expedition to Antarctica in late 1938 and 1939. Now, there is confirmation that Hess knew something about Antarctica, because when he landed in Britain and was eventually taken captive by the British, during the early weeks of his captivity, Prime Minister Churchill sent a number of emissaries, personal emissaries, to talk with Hess, and these meetings were very, very, very secret. And one of the individuals, I think it was Ivan Kirkpatrick, if my memory serves me correctly, was told to go meet with Hess and inquire more about the terms of peace that Hess brought with him. And while Churchill's emissary is visiting Hess, he asks Hess very directly, well, you're offering these terms of peace. What about Greece and what about Norway? And to me, Norway is a code for Antarctica, and here's why. When the German Antarctic expedition came back to Germany, it had, of course, staked out of claim in Antarctica in a region that was also claimed by Norway. And Norway sent a diplomatic note to the German Foreign Ministry that Germany had no claim on this land. It was not legal. The German reply was, yes, it is legal because, number one, you have kind of relinquished your claim because you've done no further exploration or development of it. And number two, the German expedition actually explored areas much further inland than the Norwegians ever had. So the Germans disputed the Norwegian claim. So when the Germans invade Norway, of course, from the German point of view, that settles the issue. The Norwegian government under King Haakon goes into exile in Great Britain and continues to be the legitimately recognized Norwegian government by the British. So I suspect, if you put all of this into context, I suspect that when Churchill's emissary is asking Hess about Norway, this is really a code for Antarctica. In other words, what the British are trying to find out is, where does Antarctica fit in to your peace proposals and your divvying up the globe in terms of spheres of influence between Germany and the United Kingdom? I suspect this is really what's going on there.
Okay, I know you mentioned in your book that you don't believe in it, about bases of the Nazi that might have built on Antarctica, but there's a lot of people out here that believe that there might be a base in Antarctica, and what if Hess is in Antarctica? What do you think about this? Do you still believe that they might be able to just maintain a weather station, or are they capable of actually maintaining life there?
Well, no, I've never believed that. There, you know, I wrote a book that left the question open, and a lot of academics jumped all over me because of that. But in point of fact, I've never believed that there was any sort of Nazi base there. And it's a rather complex question, and I'm hoping that we'll be able to return to it after the break, because I don't think I'll be able to get through all of this before the break. But there are two basic questions. There are two basic considerations here about the Nazi base in Antarctica. Actually three. Number one, the people that have put out the story about Nazi Antarctic bases are themselves linked to neo-Nazi groups, both in Canada and in Austria after the war. So in other words, I'm suspicious of it simply because of the source that ultimately is responsible for the mythology. But number two, The practicality of sustaining any sort of base, military, you know, secret UFO bases, secret research facilities, or otherwise, are simply, from a military operational logistics standpoint, impossible for the German Navy to sustain a base like that in Antarctica when its resources are very limited. And of course, its primary operational brief during the war is to interdict British supplies. So you're really asking the German Navy to do something that even with countries with much larger navies like Great Britain or the United States would have found very, very difficult to do, especially during wartime. So my principal argument and objection to this whole Nazi base in Antarctica is based on simply the raw logistics and realities of the wartime situation. The third problem is a little more complex, because the people, and I may get through it before the break, the people that have been arguing that, you know, there was some sort of secret UFO Nazi research base in Antarctica, are doing so without much grounding in the Nazi secret projects themselves and what they actually achieved and what their requirements were in order to sustain it. The chief project that I think you could point to that would indicate the Nazis had an interest in anti-gravity, field propulsion, zero-point energy, and all that sort of stuff, was the Nazi Bell. But I've spent a number of books examining that project and trying to reverse engineer it. And the bottom line is that the facility that the Bell was being tested at required the Germans to build a power plant, an electrical power plant, right there at the facility. And that clued me in that they were using enormous amounts of direct current electricity in order to run this device. So in other words, the power requirements alone for what the Nazis were doing would have been utterly beyond putting anything in Antarctica to continue any sort of research on that type of technology, just utterly beyond. They would have had to have either attained some sort of breakthrough in that energy technology, and the evidence is not there, simply just not there for it. And number two, they would have had to have built a power plant there in order to continue that sort of research work. So I think the Nazi Antarctic base just strikes out on all three counts.
And you make a valid point there. You bring a good argument. Let's take the chance to go into a break, and when we come back, we'll go back into
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Hi, I'm Richard Valzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
With over 150 million registered users, Pal Talk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 Pal Talk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining Pal Talk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
This land is your land.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you.
And we are back on The People Speak. I am Sophia Ray, your host of the week, and we are here with Dr. Joseph Farrell talking about Hess and the Penguins, his new book that just came out in 2017 here. I wanted to talk about a little bit more about Antarctica, geopolitics, geomancy, Hess being an occultist, but there's a disclassification of the Hess files that came out just in 2017. You want to talk a little bit about that first?
Well, it's interesting that the Hess files were supposed to be completely released this year. And the first thing that I think is very intriguing about this was also the year, of course, that the JFK files were supposed to be opened up, which, of course, President Trump went ahead and did to a greater extent, I think, than the powers that be wanted him to do. So in other words, you get a measure of the importance of the Hess case that the files on him were classified to this year. The problem is the researchers that have dug into what have been released previously have pointed out that the files appear to have been doctored. Whole files and items have gone completely missing. It is almost a certainty that Hess brought with him some sort of actual draft peace treaty with Great Britain that has never been seen. So in other words, the documents itself are already tainted as a source, regardless of what they release, because, of course, you can plant false documents, you can remove documents, you can switch indexes out, and so on and so forth. So I think the key thing to take away from the documents release about Hess is that it is interesting and intriguing that it was the same year as the JFK files, and of course the Hess affair happened, you know, some two decades prior to JFK. So that gives you a measure of the importance of, really, the importance of what Rudolf Hess may have been up to.
Well, at that time, he was an occultist, right? And therefore, he was studying the laws of the universe, metaphysics. So he kind of had a lot of secret knowledge, right?
Well, it's assumed that he did. All we really know is that Hess had an interest in the occult. We don't know how extensive his library was. You know, all of that is been carefully hidden. We do know that he was a member of the Thule Gesellschaft, as I said, prior to the Nazi assumption of power in 1933. But beyond this, we really don't know that much about what he personally held. Hess was very much the Amanos Gris. He was very much kind of the brains behind the throne. In fact, there were American articles that appeared in 1943 that actually questioned whether or not Hess may have been the real intelligence, you know, behind Adolf Hitler. And most people don't realize that while Hitler and Hess were in prison, in Landsberg prison, it was actually Hess that came up with the title Mein Kampf. And it was actually Hess that even personally wrote the more lucid passages in the book. So in other words, Hess, yeah, we know that Hess was an intelligent man. And we know that he had major interests in the occult. We know that he was very capable as a historian. He had some facility with mathematics and science as well. So he was not a stupid man. And he was also multilingual. You know, he was probably, in that sense, the only real cosmopolitan Nazi, if you want to put it that way, in the Nazi hierarchy. He spoke English, he spoke French, German, of course, and he also spoke Arabic to a good degree of conversational Arabic. So we don't know beyond his interest in the occult what he actually thought or believed, because again, it's his personal library is simply unknown, and he himself did not write or publish much during his period as the deputy Führer. So it's anybody's guess how extensive his knowledge really was.
There's a large number of persons out here who are unaware of what geopolitics is and geomancy. Before mm-hmm. continuing, can you just define those two for our listeners?
Well, geomancy is the occult practice of using certain so-called sacred sites to practice magic and to work magic, not only on people, but on, you know, on the planet, and to use the planet in turn to work magic on people. It's a very, very old practice. You get, you know, feng shui, the Chinese practice, is to a certain extent geomancy, and the whole idea of ley lines and telluric currents and all of that, to a certain extent, is geomancy. Geopolitics is something very, very different. This was a field of study that began to get its formal recognition in the late 19th century, particularly with the British, you know, the first real geopolitician, a fellow British fellow by the name of Halford Mackinder. And you had a number of people since then that have picked up on geopolitics and have made it their study. You know, in this country, think of Zbigniew Brzezinski, President Carter's national security advisor, would certainly be a geopolitician. Geopolitics is simply the science of power politics of the great powers, and how geography and their geographical and cultural tradition affect their policy over time. So in other words, geopolitics looks at things very long-term. It's kind of ideology-free, because if you look very carefully at the way great powers behave, their policies, regardless of what type of government is in power, tends to be the same, simply based on their position on the map, so to speak.
And so Hitler had a society, like a secret society or a lodge of some sort that I recall reading in the book. It might be in The Grid of the Gods, where he was placed, the lodge was placed at certain ley lines. Is that correct?
It was Grid of the Gods. It was Grid of the Gods. The Nazis did place certain installations of theirs along supposed grid lines or ley lines, the most infamous case of which is the positioning of Hitler's eastern headquarters in East Prussia, the Volkshans, the Wolf's Lair, that big massive set of concrete bunkers and so on. They were so massive you can still visit them in Poland today. You know, they were just too big to be destroyed. But yeah, they positioned a number of their sites. The other famous one being the big German radio broadcast towers outside of Cologne, Germany, which were supposedly placed on a number of these ancient lines. Another installation would have been a mysterious radio transmitter of some sort that was located at the Brocken, you know, the famous mountain where supposedly the Walpurgisnacht took place. So yeah, the Nazis apparently did have some sort of occult influence working in the background, but again, we don't know the documents or the sources where they're getting this from or why they're doing this. This has been almost completely obscured by history. There's no evidence trail. In other words, all we have are the interesting work of interwar people that were involved in occult research inside of Germany, and then the unusual placement of Nazi facilities, too coincidentally, along positions that some of these researchers had uncovered. So, yeah, there's something going on.
For those who are tuned in to Dr. Joseph Farrell and have questions or comments, they can call toll-free at 1-888-429-5471. I feel like I'm jumping back and forth here, so please bear with me. I was thinking Antarctica again. Now, you mentioned a list of strange visitors. let's talk a little bit about that. What's going on with that?
Well, Antarctica, if you look at the people associated with Antarctica, it's the most bizarre list you could ever come up with. You know, beginning with Hermann Göring, who sponsors the Nazi expedition. Then you have Rudolf Hess, probably knowing, you know, everything about that expedition. Plus, you know, the strange statement and conversation he had with Churchill's representative. But in recent times, look at the people that have gone to visit Antarctica. We had, first of all, the Secretary of State, John Kerry, went to Antarctica during the height of one of the most hotly contested elections in the United States. He's on a diplomatic junket, and then we were told that he decided to kind of take a side trip to Antarctica to study climate change firsthand, you know. And when I heard that, I just thought, no, this is nuts. You know, he's the Secretary of State, for crying out loud. He can call up, you know, at his office in Washington, D.C., and get all the Antarctic climate change data in the world, you know, and have it right at his fingertips. Kerry went there, and then shortly after that, you had the Patriarch of Moscow, of all people, Kirill III, went to Antarctica. And again, we were told the story that he went there to bless the little Russian Orthodox chapel that the Russians had built there. And again, I thought, you know, there's something more going on here, because any Orthodox bishop can do that. You don't need to get the Patriarch of Moscow down there to do that. So you had the Patriarch of Moscow. Then you had Buzz Aldrin, you know, Apollo 11 astronaut, went down there. And, you know, so stop and look at this list. You had Prince Harry of Great Britain at one point went to Antarctica. You had King Juan Carlos at another point went to Antarctica. So if you stop and look at this list, just look at how bizarre it is. Hermann Göring, Rudolf Hess, Kirill III, Secretary of State John Kerry, Apollo astronaut Buzz Aldrin, King Juan Carlos of Spain, and Prince Harry of Great Britain. So, if you were to put that on a multiple choice question, what do the following people have in common? The answer is Antarctica. just from the list itself, it looks to me like something very bizarre is going on down there. And we're not being told what it is, but something bizarre is going on down there.
Why do you think we're not being told? Is it the public can't handle the truth, or?
Well, that's the excuse that they always use. I do think the public can handle the truth. I think probably what's really going on is my suspicion has always been that, beginning perhaps with the Nazi expedition itself, and then the high jump expedition that the United States mounted after the war, that they may have found something that may indicate that there was some sort of advanced civilization there. Because if you stop and think about it, Antarctica is the one place on planet Earth that most obviously fills all the bills for Atlantis. It's a big continent that's literally underwater. It's literally buried under lots of ice. Ooh. So I've always suspected that there's something having to do with a lost ancient civilization that may have been on that continent at one point, and that they may have found evidence of it. And if you really want to crawl way out onto the end of the twig of speculation here, in my thinking, there's all sorts of documentary textual evidence that this very, very ancient civilization, lost in the mists of prehistory, was probably a very advanced technological civilization. So if they found any evidence of that, they're going to keep it hushed up, particularly because it may be a technological gold mine of some sort that could be potentially very, very dangerous. So from that standpoint alone, they keep a lid of classification on it. But yeah, it's a very bizarre list when you stop and think about it. Hermann Göring, patriarchs of Moscow, moon astronauts, secretaries of state, kings of Spain, and princes of Great Britain. It's just a bizarre list. Huh?
Now, I can't end this show without asking you this question. What is the connection between Hess and 9/11?
Well, there's nothing in that book that directly connects it to 9/11, except the fact that Spandau Prison was torn down within 48 hours of Hess's death. The real Nazi 9/11 connection I get into in the previous book that came out just before that one, called Hidden Finance, Rogue Networks, and Secret Sorcery. There is a whopper of, so to speak, a Nazi connection with 9/11, and you really have to read the book to find out what it is. Because when I found it out, I sat with my jaw on the floor for several minutes when I read it. But it's there, uncomfortably, it's there, but. It's not in the Hess book. I think if you read both books together, you'll get the impression that the world is a lot stranger than we've been told.
Definitely, because it's strange already. You've been pretty busy. So, are you working on something new already?
I'm researching a new book. Will probably not be out this year because there's just a mountain of research I've got to do. And I know everybody wants me to tell them what it's going to be about, but I just do not do that. I've learned the hard way over the years not to tell what I'm actually working on. I'm hoping that I'll get it done and print it up sometime next year.
Give our listeners, you know, where they can find your books at. Hess and the Penguins just came out this year. Is that correct?
Yeah, just came out. Yeah, just came out a couple months ago, as a matter of fact. Most of my books they can get right off my website, which is www.GizaDeathStar.com. The books ultimately do come from Amazon. I just get a few extra pennies if you order them off my website. The Hess book, Hess and the Penguins, is not up on my website yet, so you can go to Barnes & Noble or Amazon or order directly from the publisher, which is Adventures Unlimited Press.
Now, is there anything that you want to bring out about Hess and the Penguins, maybe something that haven't gone over already before the show's over here?
No, I think we pretty well covered it. You know, there's a few things, but we haven't got enough time to go into them at this juncture. I think we pretty well covered it.
Okay. I'm going to finish up the Grid of the Gods. I would like to have you back and do a review on that. Even though that's an older book, but I kind of like what I'm reading. It's going to take me a little bit, but I would love to have you back and go through that book. Would you be up for it?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, great. Everybody, Dr. Joseph Farrell, you can find his book at any bookstore. You know, I try to find your books at the library, and unsurprisingly, I couldn't find many of your books at the library. Why is that?
Largely, I think probably libraries just don't stock those kinds of books. They regard them as, you know, conspiracy theory or nonsense or things like that. That would be my best guess. I do try and research my books and footnote them, but you know they're not the kind of book that libraries normally stock. So I'm not surprised.
So before I let you go, I have to ask you a personal opinion question, and that's on the flat Earth theory. What is your opinion of the flat Earth theory?
I never argue mathematics with people that think 2 + 2 = 5. In other words, I don't waste my time.
Really? So you don't think in all the expeditions
No, I don't.
Not one. Okay. Hey, well, that's interesting, because a lot of people believe that, you know, the Arctic is a circle that circles around the entire globe not just the South.
I don't. I'm sorry. It's such nonsense to me. I don't waste my time with it. I just really don't.
Okay, so just one more question. What is Hess' connection with Israel?
Oh, that's the thing that we simply don't have time to go into.
We got about 7 minutes.
Seven?
About six minutes.
Well, Hess was, so to speak, the conscience of the Nazi Party. He co-signed all the legislation of Nazi Germany prior to his flight to Great Britain. So Hess did co-sign the Nuremberg race laws. But he, like so many Nazi leaders in and around Adolf Hitler, is strange in the sense that Hess was personal friends with General Karl Haushofer, who was kind of the geopolitical guru for Nazi Germany. Well, Haushofer's wife was half Jewish, and Hess always maintained a kind of personal protection to the Haushofer and the Haushofer family. More importantly, Hess was, number one, he was involved with the Night of the Long Knives. In other words, he was instrumental in persuading Hitler to move against the SA. But by the same token, he was also heard arguing with Hitler very, very vehemently to take certain people off of the death list. And it was after the Night of Long Knives that Hess began to experience the stomach problems that plagued him the rest of his life. In other words, there was kind of a psycho somatic response to the bloodshed. But more importantly, during the Reichskristallnacht, the 1938 pogrom against the Jews, when Jewish shops and synagogues were looted and burned, Hess repeatedly tried to get Hitler to back off and tone down, you know, the atrocities. So there is the possibility that Hess, and I think it's a very strong possibility, that Hess, when he went to Great Britain with his peace proposal, one of the things that he was trying to do was to sign off jointly with the British on the creation of a Zionist Jewish homeland in order to prevent the genocide. And in a certain sense, the failure of his mission all but guaranteed that the genocide would go forward. It's a much murkier case than, you know, I'm making it sound here, and it's a much darker case because there's a lot of things about this period of history that have simply been suppressed or whitewashed. But I do think that Hess was trying to prevent that. I'm not trying to make him out to be some sort of martyr, because the other thing that Hess was really wanting to do was to head off a two-front war and allow Germany, you know, to swing the full force of its military might on the invasion of the Soviet Union. So, you know, he was perfectly happy to go ahead with that grisly exercise. But I do think that part of his concern was this approaching genocide, and he was trying to head it off. And he was in contact with people inside of Great Britain that were similarly concerned. The so-called British Peace Party had raised similar concerns. So there were a number of people on both sides that were trying to head something off. And the Hess mission very clearly was somehow a part of all of this.
Indeed. You know, this is the time where we have to come to wrap up the show. Joseph Farrell, it was great having you. I appreciate it. I look forward to having you again. I want to give a big thanks out to Don Newsom, our engineer, and Sean, and to our producer, Mike Kim. I want to give a big thanks out to our listeners. Tune in next Tuesday for more People Speak. Be part of the change for a better planet. May we unite through love and light. Be good to one another.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.